Our next speaker is Dennis Venema from Trinity Western University, and the topic is Adam, Eve, and Craig, an interrogation of William Lane Craig's In Quest of the Historical Adam.
Great, thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I want to thank the ASA for sliding me in at the last minute. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to be here, but it's been an absolute delight. And thank you for the warm welcome to my family and the students that are here with me as well. I'd like to start by acknowledging that the land that I work and live on is the traditional unceded territory of a number of First Nations people groups, the Katsi, the Semiamu, the Kwantlen, the Stolo, and the Squamish. And I'd also like to acknowledge that the land that we're on here is also the traditional unceded territory of a number of people groups as well, and I'm grateful for the welcome. Okay, the task at hand today is a brief conversation on William Lane Craig and his engagement with my book a number of years ago. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Dr. Craig. And I hope that this is a dialogue that, while at times perhaps critical, will be viewed as a dialogue between brothers in Christ. And also, one of the things that I would say about just my work in general over the years is I've tried to be a critic from within, because I strongly feel that we need critique within the evangelical community. And I'm sensitive to that critique, that it comes from within the community, because I'm conscious of how we are viewed from the outside. So perhaps this is the critique of a wounded lover, but such as it is. Okay, so every story has a context. My context is probably familiar to some of you. I worked for the BioLogos Foundation for a number of years as their fellow of biology. That came out of a paper that I wrote for Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith many, many years ago now, back in 2010. One of the earlier sort of forefronting of this idea of population genetics and what impact that field might have for understanding of Adam and Eve. Some of you might remember back in 2011 that was a front page news in Christianity Today. It was picked up by Christianity Today, and that article there mentions BioLogos and me. There were editorials, there was NPR, it got a call out on the Colbert Report. My life got very, very interesting for a while. Perhaps the biggest surprise was that conservative Christians in the States listened to NPR. Who knew? Okay, so I thought when they interviewed me, I'm like, oh, it's NPR. No one that cares is going to listen to this. Yeah, I was wrong. My work with BioLogos over the years, and also some BioLogos funding, and also SCIO. SCIO was mentioned as one of the partner organizations, and some of my colleagues from that SCIO cohort are here as well. That led to this collaboration with Scott McKnight to publish this book in 2017, where Scott and I put forward some ideas about population genetics, intelligent design, and the historical Adam in the New Testament and such. So that's kind of the background. I have to say, I really like some of the reviews. I kind of have this mildly perverse enjoyment of reading negative reviews. So there you go. Bad science and even worse theology. All right, so what were the main conclusions of Adam and the genome? What sort of led to the current conversation that's between Dr. Craig and I? So Adam and the genome makes a few claims. Now, there's an asterisk here, just like with every good scientific claim, and there's philosophers who can do a better job of the epistemology than I can. But the idea is, you know, scientifically, we can be quite certain of certain things with all the appropriate caveats. So Adam and the genome does attempt to lay out what those caveats are and do a little bit of philosophy of science. Even though I do not come from a liberal arts background, having just been trained at sort of a state school, but hanging out with philosophers and theologians over the years has been helpful. So Adam and the genome makes a few claims. that humans, and in that book I define humans as Homo sapiens, that's a particular choice. In the literature, you will see, in popular literature, you will sometimes see human referred to as Homo sapiens, and that's a fine convention to use. Or sometimes you'll see humans as Homo, like the whole group of Homo. And it's just, you know, some popular writing can kind of go either way. I made the choice to go with humans as Homo sapiens. It's pretty hard to write a book about the origins of humanity without using the word human. So that was the choice that I made. So what I defend in that book is that Homo sapiens do not uniquely descend from two individuals within the last 200,000 years. At that time of publication, we hadn't yet found older, morphologically modern human remains, although in the book I do discuss that this is likely going to be revised as more evidence comes in. The other thing that I put forward is that there's no evidence that the lineage that leads to humans, to Homo sapiens, dipped to two individuals, stretching back prior to any reasonable definition of humanness, as I understood it. Now, this generated some pushback, and that's all fine and good. That's what scientific discussion is all about, sharpening of ideas and response. So the pushback to Adam and the genome I found to be quite interesting. The pushback was, you know, Homo sapiens does not necessarily equal human. We might need to think about reaching back prior to Homo sapiens arriving in the fossil record. And fair enough, like I just mentioned, Homo versus Homo sapiens is an active, you know, conversation. And one of the things I underscore in the book is that we're talking about a gradient here, right? There's no easy line of demarcation anyway, so that ambiguity is already kind of baked in. So that was the first pushback. The second pushback is that ancestral population sizes are averages. Absolutely they are. We don't have a generation by generation snapshot of everything in the past. I mean, wouldn't it be lovely if we did? But we absolutely don't. So one of the pushbacks is that perhaps because these are averages, perhaps hidden in that average is a very sudden reduction to two individuals, followed by exponential growth back up. And that little blip is enough that it would be fast enough that it would just be lost in the average. So even though we can look at averages, perhaps hiding in that average is this rapid dip and recovery. And kicking that around with some people led to a conclusion that, yeah, even something that is extreme as that thing, that would actually be hidden to current methods. And we can be fairly confident that that has not happened within the last 500,000-ish to 700,000-ish years. It kind of depends on where you place the Neanderthal divergence, because obviously once we're talking about Neanderthals diverging, we're talking about, you know, more than two, as it were. Okay, so given the brevity of the talk and time, and also because I want to leave time for questions, we're not really going to do a deep dive into the lines of evidence here. This slide is just to point out that the data are not in dispute. We're not, the conversation is not about what the data show, as it were. The conversation is, in light of this data, what are possible options and what sort of maneuvers might need to be made to find options, as it were. So those that, you know, there's good resources available. The BioLogos website has a lot of good stuff. And Steve Schaefer's stuff is absolutely fantastic. Steve at the Broad Institute has worked with BioLogos. There's still a ton of my stuff up on BioLogos as well, although it's been a number of years since I've written for them. The idea here is, yeah, we're looking at a body of evidence, and Christians are approaching that and asking themselves the question, okay, in light of these lines of evidence, what sort of options are reasonable options to have on the table? And there's differences of opinion on that. There are different comfort levels within the evangelical community for sort of what sort of options are available. And we're gonna get into that. We'll see what some responses are. A nice phylogeny just showing you the complicated nature of the history of our lineage and our relatives, and whether one draws the circle of humanness in a certain place or not. Again, one of the things that's a constant theme in my writing is that we're dealing with gradients, and it's very difficult to draw lines of demarcation on a gradient. So Adam, where are you? I sometimes jokingly call this pin the Adam on the phylogeny. But that's sort of where we're at. So there's a couple of different options here. We could have an ancient genetic atom. So if you are quite interested in soul genetic progenitorship of Adam, if that's theologically important to you, then the option that you have is an ancient genetic atom. Taking Adam back far enough to have some sort of reasonable argument that Adam and Eve could be genetic progenitors of all of humanity. The other option, and this has been discussed here at the conference in other venues, the other option, of course, is a recent genealogical Adam. So that places Adam much more recently, and Adam is not the sole genetic or even a genetic progenitor of modern day humans, but is a genealogical ancestor of all living humans. So those are kind of the different options. So back to the claims of Adam in the genome. We've got average ancestral population sizes, and perhaps we need to think about Homo sapiens as not equaling human. This actually, these critiques that we've just discussed, I was actually somewhat pleased that those were the critiques, because they actually underscore the conclusions of Adam in the genome, that we do not uniquely descend from two individuals in the last 200,000-ish years or so. The other thing I discuss in Adam in the genome is that we also see no evidence in the past of any sort of ancestral population size average that is lower than that. So that's sort of the state of the evidence. So in a way, these critiques actually underscore that the conversation has shifted from what I was arguing for in Adam in the genome. And in light of that evidence, we're shifting to other options or other conversations. Okay, so if you're going to find an Adam and Eve, you have to either push far back into the past, or you have to play with definitions. You have to discuss humanness in ways that perhaps Christians haven't discussed humanness in the past. And you either have to invoke major or minor miracles in order to get these situations to work. So pushing far back into the past might appear to be kind of the less miracle-laden option. And I would agree that the miracles there are sort of more subtle. Certainly recent genealogical models require what we would consider fairly major miracles, like de novo creation of a pair or something like that, within a biologically compatible, but some ways not however one chooses to define human in a genealogical context. Okay, so I think of these two options as either, then this is a bit snide, so forgive me. Again, this is me after a drink or two kind of thinking about these options. But again, I hope you hear it in a charitable tone. So I think of this as kind of the error bar, Adam. It's like, oh, here's one solution. We'll just take Adam and Eve and run them back to the error bar of current technology. We'll just make Adam and Eve old enough that we can't be certain that they're not back there. I have concerns about that because whenever we kind of do that maneuver before, error bars have a habit of moving. This error bar Adam is already back at 700,000 years ago-ish, 500 to 700,000 years ago. Could that go farther back? Possibly, based on current technology or future technology? Absolutely. I think of the recent genealogical options kind of as a deus ex machina kind of a thing. It's like, oh, this unexpected resolution of the problem, kind of from Greek theater. So my talk here, of course, is Craig, because Craig has this book where he engages with my material, and Craig chooses the ancient genetic Adam, sort of the error bar Adam. Okay, so an ancient genetic Adam is simply taking Adam and Eve as a couple far enough back in the past that we cannot disprove that they were there. Okay, so first off, let me start with some praise for Craig's work. And it's a lovely book, and the students that are here with me can attest that I assigned it to them in their evolution class this last semester. And the reason for that is that obviously, even though I don't agree with Craig, I think his ideas are worth substantially engaging with. And he has done his homework. He has taken the genetic and paleontological record very seriously. He's attempting to achieve an intellectually rigorous position, which, I mean, if you're familiar with William Lane Craig, you know that that's definitely his thing. He wants to deal with the current evidence as we have it to the best of his ability. So kudos there to Craig. Craig also does not favor recent genealogical Adam scenarios and favors an ancient sole genetic progenitorship model, although whether or not Craig actually goes in for full genetic progenitorship or has some wiggle room for perhaps kind of genealogical-ish kind of things within that ancient Adam, you can see that in the book. It's nuanced. But here's a point of agreement between Craig and I. Even though I find both models unsatisfactory, I find recent genealogical models to be more problematic. So it seems that Craig and I agree on that particular point. You gotta say nice stuff before you say the tough stuff, right? Yeah. Craig also fully recognizes that future advances may push back his Adam, which is fine, that's good. I think the way that Craig has sort of laid the framework for how he's dealing with things theologically and with respect to Genesis, I think is going to be robust enough for that pushback. He's already sort of working with the tensions of a 700,000-year-old Adam and squaring that with the culture and setting that Genesis is depicting. So he's already kind of laid some of that groundwork. Okay, so there are challenges, of course, for this error bar Adam. So the idea that hiding in these average population sizes prior to 700,000 years ago, that there's a sudden population bottleneck and a rebound from that, that is what I would kind of call one of the first sort of minor miracles, that sort of is there and we just can't detect it. So I'm not a philosopher, and I kind of made these up, and my philosopher friends will probably take me to task later, but I call this kind of special plead one or minor miracle one, right? These two individuals would also happen to have either maximum or near maximum genetic heterozygosity, because we're dealing with something here called the time to the most recent four alleles or ancestors and ancestors with genetic diversity. I'm not sure he's done his homework to know that that's kind of part of the conversation. But the idea that this bottleneck would also fortuitously have two individuals that are also very genetically diverse from one another, near maximum, that is not likely. Especially if those two individuals are geographically close to one another. So I would kind of say that this is a special plead too, or a minor miracle too, maybe not so minor. Here's the one that I really struggle with. I really struggle with this one. Craig has a view that these individuals had either modern cognitive capacity or the very much sort of the potential for modern cognitive capacity. I'm not exactly certain. You can read the book exactly where he stands on this. But there is no evidence for many behaviors that we consider modern in the archaeological record for a span of many 100,000 years after this point. And Craig spends a good chunk of time trying to defend that, why this cognitive set is there 700 plus thousand years ago, perhaps, and yet we don't see behavioral modernity in the record for a very, very long time afterward. So I would sort of say that's a special plead three, or a minor, maybe not so minor, miracle three. Okay, so challenges here, and again, those are kind of the bullet points. Here's kind of a summary. The biggest issue I have is that there's no positive evidence for support of any of these conjectures. We just don't have any positive evidence for this. From an apologetics perspective, the best that can be said about this proposed scenario is that we can't disprove it. And I think we need to sit with that for a bit and ask ourselves some hard questions about that. Are we comfortable with models advanced as apologetics arguments, that the best thing we can say about them is, well, you can't disprove it. I pause there. That one's hard. This puts this argument, unfortunately, and this as an aside, like not as an aside, if you know William Lane Craig, he doesn't normally engage in apologetics arguments other than strong ones, right? Craig and I don't see eye to eye on many things, but I have a lot of respect for his work, and he's done a lot of good work apologetically. But I think this is a bit of a misstep. I think this particular choice that he's made is not in keeping with his prior corpus. It puts this argument right into the absolutely weakest tier of apologetics arguments. You might be familiar with ideas like Russell's Teapot or Last Thursdayism. Now, hear me correctly. This is not to say that I'm equating these things, right? I'm not saying William Lane Craig is engaging in Last Thursdayism, but I'm just saying this is how it's going to appear potentially from the outside, right? People are going to say, oh, no positive evidence for any of this. That's kind of like, right? Because these happen to be in the same philosophical category. They don't have any positive evidence in their favor, and they too cannot be disproven. Okay. Christians, I think we could admit this. If these kinds of arguments were being advanced by somebody from a different faith, if a Muslim or a Hindu or a Mormon was advancing these sorts of arguments, I think we would rightly reject them as weak and unsatisfactory. We would say this is a weak argument and it reveals the intellectual weakness of the position. And I'm afraid that what we're doing here is that. And I am saying we because I consider myself an evangelical Christian and within the camp of Craig as a brother in Christ. I'm very much concerned about the missional impact of embracing or even entertaining at some sort of serious level these sorts of arguments, because I think it signals to intelligent observers outside the faith that Christianity may not be an intellectually rigorous position. So, these arguments are inside arguments. They're arguments that are intended to shore up the faith of people who are already committed to a concordism of some variety. If these arguments have any sorts of value, it is only for those of us who are already within the fold, who are struggling with this, and we feel that, you know, to give up a genetic progenitorship atom, that somehow comes some kind of loss. These are a net negative, in my opinion, from a missional perspective. If I'm going to go and share my faith with a colleague who is not a believer, who is a geneticist or just a scientist of some nature, or even just a well-read layperson, and I advance this sort of argument, why should they accept this sort of argument when they would similarly reject, say, Mormon apologetics for why the archaeological record of North America looks nothing like the Book of Mormon? And I wouldn't have a good answer for them at that point. I really wouldn't. Okay, we're near the end. Sometimes people ask me, sort of like, you know, oh, you know, Dennis, you must have been great to write that book, and like, you know, there's another book out with Cambridge now, and that kind of stuff, which is fantastic. I've been really blessed to have some amazing co-authors, and I've happily ridden their coattails. This actual article is among my favorites. If you can be an author and your published things are your favorite, like your kids are your favorites, this one might be the favorite child. It's from a slightly different context. This is many years ago, 2011, when I was having quite a bit of back and forth with Stephen Meyer and his book, Signature in the Cell, and about the origin of the genetic code and whether you build an apologetic on the presumed failure of science and such like that. The parallels here are not absolutely the same. I don't think Craig is building a God of the gaps argument per se. Slightly different, but some of the principles in this article are relevant here. Population genetics is an advancing science. That error bar is probably going to get shifted further back. What happens when that error bar is in the Australopithecines, potentially, or who knows what? Then what happens? What happens to the faith of young people who kind of held on by their fingernails because of Craig's arguments? I'm not sure. Do I also have, you know, empathy for those of us, those students who are kind of hanging on by their fingernails? Yes. But I don't think a more elaborate and better concordism is the solution here. I think a better solution is to have a reflection about whether or not concordism is the best option in the first place. So that quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, is one of my absolute favorites. It's in Adam and the Genome as well. I'll leave that up on the slide for a while. The next slide just says questions and discussion, so I'll just leave this there if you'd like to read, and I'll welcome your questions at this point. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dennis. And yes, we have time for a couple of questions here.
Thank you, Bob. Dennis, great talk, and you've written some very good books on this topic. I want to address the thought of concordism. The more I read the Bible carefully, the more I realize that we have concordism to a pre-1850 way of thinking. For example, in Genesis 1, we talk about Adam humanity. Genesis 2 is about Adam and Eve, and those can be completely different things. Acts 17:26, if most of the Bibles we read now say, for from one man God made all humanity, but I've done about 200 pages of tables to look at where did that concept come from, and it's not in any manuscripts from before the first millennium was up. So we've added that word, and that was concordism to a pre-1850 concept. I use 1850 because that's the time of Darwin. And if you look at a lot of the concordances and all those kind of things, there's that word concordance in there again, they say, well, this, the ones we now read say, well, this person back in the 1930s said so and so. And the ones in the 1930s say, those people in the 1910s say so and so. And those people back in the 1850s say so and so. But if you go back to the original Bible, the concept of Adam and Eve being the very first humans isn't written directly in the Bible. And I can take anybody here and walk through that, through all the five or six passages that people usually refer to. What are your thoughts about that?
Great, thank you for the question. You know, I'm gonna shamelessly plug Scott McKnight and his half of the book. Scott did some really fine work, because he tackles the issue of, wow, references to Adam and how that's used in the Old Testament after the early chapters of Genesis. Adam is kind of a no-show for a while. So why is Paul picking up Adam and using Adam in these ways? And the reason for that is there's that whole intertestamental period where Adam sort of resurfaces, and Adam and Eve, well, usually Adam, he's used in various theological ways in intertestamental Judaism. So Scott's main contribution to that conversation, the whole scholarly conversation on this topic in that second half of the book, was to take us through, you know, what does it mean for an ancient Jew like Paul, trained as a rabbinic Jew, to pick up and use Adam in ways? And as Christians, we kind of just mentally go, oh, right, Paul's just going back to Genesis, just like we learned, right? But Paul is not going back to Genesis. Paul is drawing on a tradition, a rich rabbinic tradition from the intertestamental period. So there's some good work there. Another shout out, of course, would be to people like John Walton and Pete Enns and whatnot. Lots of good resources there. Thank you for the question.
Another question. Does Craig deal at all with our best kind of historical, critical, biblical scholarship on how the first chapters of Genesis were produced and located within their own ancient Near Eastern context for other kinds of creation myths? Is he saying that 500,000-year-old Adam would have been able to, you know, there would have been sufficient, you know, language and cultural transmission of knowledge to kind of preserve that story orally until about the time that our biblical scholars say that these texts were actually written down?
I'll admit to not having thoroughly read the first chapters of the book. I've kind of skimmed it, but of course I had to focus on the later chapters. So yes, Craig does interact with that. I don't have the depth to sort of say he actually goes here or there. I mean, I didn't really get to it in the talk, but the observation that a non-concordist take on this whole thing also aligns best with recent and not so recent biblical scholarship about the ancient setting and context of Genesis is sort of icing on the cake. Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Okay, one more here.
You commented about William Craig and how his work is seen outside the faith community. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and to me, the word myth was typically meant Greek mythology. This is not true. And Craig, you chose to use his model and call it mytho-history, which troubles me greatly because as his story is heard across our young people in churches, it says, oh, that's just myth, that makes the Bible. They perceive he's saying that the Bible is myth-type history, which, of course, is not the academic definition. I'd like to hear your opinion.
You know, I can give you my observations as a professor, as a number of my students interacted with his book, and they found it very, very helpful. Very helpful. His interaction and his sort of approach to that is anything but simplistic. And my students did find it very, very helpful. And I was grateful that I had assigned the book for that conversation. It generated very good conversations. Yeah, my concern is not so much about its impact within the faith. I think it's what we need to be talking about. My concerns are about its appearances from the outside primarily. But thanks for the question.
Great. Well, thank you, Dennis. Let's thank Dennis, all our speakers, and also our technical crew this morning who did such a fine job.